Welcome back to Stack Trace, the podcast that's all about life and technology from two developers' perspective. And those two developers are both me, John Sundell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Rambo?
Hi, John. Doing great.
Awesome. And I'm also doing great. And I've been really, really happy to see just how many people that have shared our show during the last week using our hashtag share Stack Trace. Have you also seen all of this really nice, love for our show on Twitter?
Yes, I have. It's so much fun to see people sharing the show and talking about the things they like. I'm really happy about it.
Yeah, me too. So thanks so much to everybody who has been tweeting with that hashtag share Stack Trace, which we also talked about on the last episode. Really, really helps us to, you know, get the show to more people. And also, it's just really motivating to see people share what they like about our show. And sometimes, you know, when you're podcasting, it's a little bit like, you know, we are sitting here talking together and then we're putting this MP3 file out into the void of the internet and then that's it, right? So it's really nice to get some kind of feedback from listeners. So we really, really appreciate it. And like we mentioned on the previous episode as well, this is a little bit of a competition. So we are going to pick a winner this Sunday on the 7th of June who wins our mentorship session with me and Rambo. So you still have a few more days when this episode airs to use that hashtag share Stack Trace. Share something about the show, like your favorite episode or just a link to the show, whatever you'd like. And we'll pick a random winner from all of those tweets and invite them to a mentorship session, which I think is going to be a lot of fun.
Absolutely.
So Rambo, besides checking Twitter, what have you been up to?
Why? I haven't just been checking Twitter, John. I have work to do.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought that was just all that you do all day, is just sit on Twitter.
No. So I've been still working on my WWDC app update. It's been going pretty well. And I'm happy to announce that we have a partnership with CocoaHub.
Oh, yeah. That's really cool.
Yeah.
I always love seeing when different people and people who are creating things in the community kind of get together and collaborate like this. That's really cool to see.
Yeah, so this is something we've been meaning to do for a long time. And when I say we, I mean we, the people who develop the WWDC app. It's not just me, there are more contributors. And this is something we've been thinking about since, I don't know, since version 6 shipped a few years ago, that we wanted to have the app be also a place where you could access some content from the community, not just content from Apple and from the Apple developer app, formerly known as the WWDC app. So we thought about doing it in several different ways, but we never quite got like to the format we wanted. And fortunately, recently, the CocoaHub app was launched and they do all the curation thing that we kind of wanted to do for the WWDC app. So I thought, well, they are kind of doing what we wanted to do and they don't have a Mac app. So I think that's a good fit. So we now have a fourth tab in the app that's called Community and it pulls content from CocoaHub using their API. And I'm really, really happy about this.
Yeah, that's really awesome. And it just goes to show, like, you know, the people who worked on the CocoaHub app, like, they really just did it to kind of, you know, help the community and to showcase all of the resources that are out there from all the different blogs and websites and podcasts and YouTube channels and everything. And now that content is also available in your app as well, which has an audience of its own, right? So then just more people will get access to that, which is just really, really great.
Yeah, definitely. So I really want to thank especially Pedro, which was the person who I dealt with to get this integration going. I'm really happy to have this resource in the app. And I'm sure it's now going to also become an app people go to check out what's going on in the community. Kind of like a very focused RSS feed reader.
Yeah, exactly. WWDC RSS. That's a long combination. Reader.
Yeah, exactly. I've been doing some other stuff in the app, doing some work with the transcripts and fixing some bugs. Also been working on the website, giving it a slightly new coat of paint. And yeah, super excited. And it's going to have a new icon as well.
Oh, really cool.
Yeah.
That's really nice because the old icon, it was really, really nice. But It's been around for a while now, so I guess it was time for like a little bit of a modernization of that icon's overall design.
Yeah, I'm going to give a spoiler here. It's not going to be completely different. It's going to be very similar to the current one, but it's going to have a theme that resembles this year's WWDC. That's all I'm going to say.
Memojis?
Oh, no, not Memoji.
Okay, perfect. That sounds really great. Really looking forward to seeing that. And another thing I think we should point out is also when we're talking about the WWDC app, which I don't think we've talked about for a while, is it's open source, right? Yeah. The entire app is open source. It's because that's something that we get requests from people occasionally is, you know, are there any code bases that you can browse if you want to learn more about specifically Mac development, right? Like we talked about it on the previous episode. And the WWDC app is a great example of that. Like it's a fully native, complete Mac app, which is not trivial. Like it does a lot of different things and it's completely open source. So even if you're not prepared to like go and contribute and, you know, work on new features, you can use it to just check the code base out, like clone the project, open it up and learn from that code base because there's just so much there.
Yeah, and there's something about this code base. And first of all, I want to say that if you're looking for a resource on how does Rambo structure his code nowadays, this is not really the best resource because it's kind of old. So it follows a certain structure that's not quite how I code these days. But since it's working, me and also the other people who work in the app, we just kept the same architecture and things like that. But there is a lot to learn from this code base. First of all, because this is not a toy project, like this is not a sample project. This is a real production app. So there's a lot of real production code inside of it, which means not very pretty code necessarily in some places, but it means this is the type of stuff you see in, quote, real life when you work in an app that is around and is used by a lot of people. And there are some corner things that not many people come across when working even with Mac apps. There is an XPC service in the app that does transcript indexing. So that's interesting. There's some really hardcore Realm stuff for the Realm database dealing with composed predicates for complex filtering and stuff like that. And there's even going to be some video editing stuff in the very near future.
Ooh, nice. Nice teaser there.
Yeah.
Another thing I will also mention as a little tip here, you know, speaking of browsing open source code bases, which I really believe is a great way to learn, is to browse closed pull requests, like pull mm-hmm. requests that have been merged, and to look at the diffs, because that way you can also get a feeling for how a certain person, you in this case, or the people you collaborate with, like how you iterate on your code base. Because that's another thing, like it's not always about the, you know, perfect, pristine, perfectly architectured code. It's also about like how do you make pragmatic decisions, like, you know, in the field? How do you make those decisions on an ongoing basis while working on a production app? Because the only way to have that like pristine, perfect code base, I think, is either A, to just write it once and then never touch it again, or B, to just rewrite it all the time, right? Because these things change. So it's not about the perfect architecture. It's not about like having the perfect code structure. It's about how can you create something that's pragmatic, that's something that we can continue working on and to maintain some order and some structure and some way for people to kind of intuitively browse the code base. Like that's for me what it's all about. And looking at the history and looking at the diffs and the pull requests and how you work, like that can also be really interesting if people are looking to learn from you, from those you work with, and from this project.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll leave a link for the repo and I think you can learn a lot. There's been some pull requests closed recently, so go look at those. There's a skip intro one that's quite interesting. So
nice.
Yeah, I recommend that one.
That's super cool.
So speaking about WWDC, John, I suspect your work recently also has something to do with it. Am I right?
That is correct. I think everything will kind of be about WWDC for me and for you for the next like month or two. there's a lot of preparation to be done. And I teased on Twitter that there will be a new version of WWDC by Sundell. And it's not just WWDC by Sundell, it's WWDC by Sundell and Friends.
Ooh.
So it's been upgraded from just me to Friends.
Wait a moment. I'm your friend.
Yeah.
So does that mean what I think it means?
It does mean what you think it means. And ooh. I think we can announce here that people will not be very, very surprised, I don't think, to hear that you are going to be one of those friends.
Yeah.
So the idea this year is for me to make the website much, much larger than what it was last year. I want to cover a lot more ground. And I want to also bring in many different kinds of perspectives, because one thing I loved doing last year was to have you, for example, my friend Anastasia, and a few other people who wrote guest articles and that I interviewed and I had conversations with that kind of also were published on the website. So it wasn't just me last year either, but I did most of the things. But, you know, there's only so much that one person can do. I think last year, during the week of WWDC, I wrote 30 articles, which is quite a lot for one week. But I don't think I can do much more than that. So if we want to cover more ground, you know, we need more people. So that's going to be the thing this year, is that there will be a lot more people writing articles, contributing, and helping out on the website. It won't be a thing where, you know, anyone can contribute. Like, it won't be completely open and, you know, people can just submit articles, because I don't feel like I have the capacity to pick between different articles in that scenario. So for this year, you know, I'm just expanding the circle a little bit to have, you know, a bunch of friends help out, write the content and to contribute to the site. So that's going to be a lot of fun. So what I'm doing right now is that I am building a brand new version of the website using Publish, because WWDC by Sundell, for those of you who don't remember or didn't listen to the show back then, was actually the predecessor, like the static site generator that I built for that was actually the predecessor for Publish. It was like the beta test of Publish, if you will. It wasn't called Publish back then. It was just called John's Static Site Generator. That was it. And it was very, very simple. So it used string-based HTML templates, like HTML files with string tokens in them that I was replacing while generating. And that was it, basically. And Publish, of course, has a much more sophisticated system. There's a lot more capabilities, and you can write all the HTML in Swift even using Plot. So I am rebuilding the site. It's going to get a brand new design. And I'm also setting up a lot of like automation and pipelines, because since I'm looking to have a lot more people write articles for the site this year, I want to make that process extremely smooth so that we can have a repo on GitHub where people can submit pull requests. And then as soon as the pull request gets merged, that will trigger a regeneration of the website, publishing the website, and then, you know, clearing the cache and everything. So I'm setting up all of that automation as well, just to make things really smooth. So it's been a lot of fun just to kind of get started with this now. And hopefully, well, I need to get it done before it will launch on June 17th. So the week before WWDC. So that's what I'm kind of 100% focused on right now.
Do you also have a feeling that a deadline makes you work harder, but not harder in the sense that, oh my God, I need to get this finished with, but like it gets you motivated?
Yeah, absolutely. Not having a deadline, like the opposite, is the number one productivity killer for me. Like if I know that I have 3 months to do something, like if I'm preparing for, you know, some conference or something like that, like it's always really, really hard to motivate myself to start like 3 months in advance. I usually start earlier than most people, I think, because I do a lot of rehearsals and stuff like that. So I don't write my slides, for example, or prepare things like the day before or even a couple of days before. I usually start earlier than that. But it is really hard to motivate yourself without that deadline. But at the same time, like since I know it's June 17th, it's still like 3 weeks out more or less from the time of recording. But I want to get it done earlier so I can test everything. I can start inviting people to the repository, you know, make sure everything works as I'm expecting. So yeah, it feels like a tight deadline, which in this case I think is good. It keeps me focused.
Yeah, absolutely. You want to make sure you don't have any major issues during the week. So you're not like trying to fix stuff instead of writing content, because it's a very hard workload during that week. I'm not sure if maybe this year it's going to be a little bit different because of the format. Maybe it's going to be a little bit lighter, but it's usually a lot of content that we want to absorb as quickly as possible to be able to give the people who are reading and listening to our content the TLDR version of things.
Exactly. And another thing is that with WWC by Sundell, which is the same as with my normal website, I don't just want to give like the intro or like just take the information from the WWC slides and just put it in an article. Yeah. I want to go more deeper and like really provide great code examples and try to understand these technologies and share my learnings from it. And that, of course, takes a lot more time than just like, you know, skimming the slides and producing an article from that. I'm not saying that's what other people do, but, you know, it depends on what kind of quote unquote reporting you want to do. Do you want to do more high level surface reporting, like, or just, you know, about the news and the announcements, or do you actually want to get more deeper under the hood of things? And I definitely want to do the latter. So yeah, that's definitely something that you have to focus on during the week. So I want to make sure that all of the infrastructure, all the automation and everything is in place. And I'm also looking to share as much as I can of this with the community. So, you know, any plugins and stuff that I write to enable this, all of the code sharing between my main website and WWC by Sundell website, I'm hoping to open source as much of that as possible and to, you know, write articles about that automation that I just talked about. So stay tuned for that. I just need to get it done first now, and then hopefully I can share more of it later after the storm has gone away after WWC.
Yeah, definitely. And the thing you mentioned about not just doing stuff that's on slides, that's so true about WWDC content, because there's always some gotchas that you need to be aware of when working with the bleeding edge, like the first beta. There's usually like, there's some API they talk about, but it doesn't actually work yet. So it's good that people like you and me, we spend the time, I guess, beating our head against the keyboard so that other people don't have to.
Right. And it's also because it's our job, right? Like, yeah, this is what we do. So that means that we have time to do it, because even though some people might take like vacation or they might have some time off to be able to consume this WWDC content, most people don't have time to like really go under the hood like that and to really examine things and then to share them as well. So, you know, we're kind of taking one for the team there, if you will, but we also really enjoy doing it. And again, it's our job and this is what we do. So yeah, I think it's all going to work out and everybody's going to be happy.
Definitely.
So WWDC is still a few weeks out. So those are news that will happen in the future. But now let's talk about news that have happened during the past week. So that's something that we do on every episode these days now. We have an in the news segment. So Rambo, what's been in the news lately in terms of the iOS developer and Apple developer community?
We have the few contact tracing exposure notification apps out using Apple system.
Yeah, that's really cool. And one thing that I have loved seeing as well, which I think we'll get into in a bit, is you remember the thing I talked about a few weeks ago that I really hoped that some of these apps would be open sourced? It turns out that some of them are actually, like a lot of countries, or maybe not a lot, but some countries are open sourcing their apps and giving them away to the world to, so other countries can then use that as inspiration to build their own apps, which I think is just amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. We can leave a link in the show notes. I think the most recent one was the one from Italy. I think the first one was Switzerland to release its app. And they're both open source.
Yeah, it's super cool. I'm really hoping that this will happen and that you will have like different forks of different countries. So it's like this country forks this other country's app and then modifies it to make it work with their country. It, like, that is really cool. And that for me is like, that's the beauty of open source right there, that people can share source code like this. And also it gives another level of transparency as well, because one thing that has been a little bit of a concern with these exposure notification and contact tracing type apps is, you know, will they turn into like surveillance tools? Yeah. And by open sourcing the code and kind of showing everything and saying, here's the whole code base, it also gives a complete different level of transparency to the country and the people who will use it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And also something I'm really happy about, at least with the one from Italy, which is the one I've been looking at, is first of all, it's very well made. Like, the app is very well architected and organized. It's very well documented. And also they didn't just like dump the code on GitHub and that was it. Like, there, it's an active repo with issues, pull requests and things like that. So it's a true open source project.
It really is. And it's even got UI tests. It's got like lots of tests. And that for me was like, there goes all of those excuses that people give, which is like, we don't have time to write tests. If an app which was developed in the middle of a pandemic to be able to counter that pandemic can have time to implement tests, then you can too.
Wow, that's the ultimate argument right there.
Yeah, exactly. I will use that forever when a client says we don't have time for testing. I will just show them the Italy Immuni app as evidence.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is really good, of course, for privacy, given that the systems that are in place, the contact tracing or exposure notification API, is a very carefully designed one in terms of the user's privacy. So I want to talk about a little bit, maybe some people might not get it yet, but why should a country or an organization not use something else instead of the official API?
Yeah, so there's been quite a lot of debate around this and like what's the best approach, and different countries have different ideas on how to, you know, implement this kind of contract tracing or exposure notification. And like with all technical decisions, there are pros and cons for each approach. And the Apple-Google system, and I will simplify here, both because, you know, we don't want to go into all of the technical details, but also because we don't really know all the technical details, even though I've read some of the documentation and, you know, how it kind of works. But an oversimplified kind of overview of it is that instead of sending a device's location to some central server and saying, here's where John is right now, John is sitting at home, John is still sitting at home, now John is sitting at home again, and he's also sitting at home. But, you know, if people are out and about, they are not sending the location all the time. Instead, with the Apple and Google system, the devices are exchanging anonymous tokens, so via Bluetooth. So, for example, you know, if I would go out to the store, and in that store, there would also be a person who is infected, or maybe doesn't know that they're infected right now, but our devices will exchange tokens so that my device has a sense of which other devices it has been in contact with recently. And then if someone of those devices, like the owner of one of those devices, reports that they have tested positive for COVID-19, that they've been infected, then I can also be alerted that I might be infected as well because I was close to one of those people. So that's kind of how that system works. But then there's, of course, a lot of different systems you could use where you could say, well, let me just send the location of all the people, because Bluetooth only works when you're really close to someone. It's not 100% reliable, of course. And if you send GPS all the time, then you can know kind of where people have been. But of course, that has a lot of privacy implications, because then all of a sudden you have a central database with a lot of location information for individual people, which isn't great in case that gets hacked or used for other purposes. Or yeah, it's just not great to have your location info stored on a server somewhere. I don't think most people would like that. So there are, of course, a lot of other solutions as well you could go for. But the problem is that the only system that can work in the background on iOS is Apple system, because it has elevated privileges. So if a country develops an app that relies on the GPS data, you can get GPS information in the background for like navigation apps and things like that. But there's a lot of limitations on iOS to how long and to what extent and what kind of operations you can do in the background. So that really, really limits those capabilities of those apps and can, you know, make them not really work very well when the user is not actively using them. And I don't think you can rely on people like always launching the app into the foreground. This is one of those things that I think most people will just install and then leave in the background. And Apple's and Google system, at least on iOS, is really the only system that can do that reliably.
Yeah, and also using the GPS all the time would completely destroy battery life for the device. And there's one aspect about GPS-based solutions I don't see discussed much, which is the accuracy one. It's not accurate at all, not enough for contact tracing, I think, because I think actual GPS satellites in like perfect conditions, it's like 3 meters or something.
Yeah, something like that. Like, well, I think 1 to 5 meters or something like that is the error margin.
Yeah, like the perfect number, we may not know, but it's around that ballpark. So
yeah,
that's not good enough for good contact tracing. So Bluetooth being a short range system is way better, because you can know with a good level of confidence the distance from one device to another. And that's used for things such as AirPods. Like in AirBuddy, I can detect if your AirPods are close or far from your Mac because of the RSSI transmission signal strength. So that's something that's very good about Bluetooth. And also it's extremely power efficient, especially since on iOS, Apple is taking advantage of their special scheduling things that they have, where they'll coalesce multiple radio operations into one big block instead of waking up the CPU every second or even less than that to do work. So that's even better for your battery life.
Yeah, exactly. And GPS is very costly in general because it needs to power up that antenna. It needs to lock onto the satellites, or, you know, getting communication with the satellites.
It's going to space.
Right, exactly. It's literally communicating with space. So yeah, it's kind of costly in that sense. And like you're saying, it's going to kind of destroy your battery life. And I think anyone, even if you're not a developer, who has like accidentally left navigation on their phone and like left the phone on a table or something and returned to it like an hour later just to discover that the phone is almost out of battery, knows what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and there are things you could do, like in terms of GPS, to only be triggered when the certain distance threshold is achieved. But even then, you still have the problem that it's just not accurate enough. And anyone who has tried to use the Apple Maps or Google Maps in a place full of tall buildings like New York or São Paulo or some huge city like that will know that even satellite GPS is not very happy in those scenarios.
Exactly. And I mean, I'm not a expert on pandemics or something like that, but I would also guess that where most kind of infections between people happen is indoors, right? Yeah. When people are in small spaces, like for example, in a shopping mall or a store, that's during lockdown why most shopping malls were closed, I guess. And here you don't have almost any GPS at all because, well, you're in one big kind of isolated space with no clear view of the sky.
Yeah, definitely. So I think Bluetooth is definitely the solution, and especially the Apple and Google system is even better because it can take advantage of all the levers that the system can pull that a normal app can't. So I think that's the way to go. And when I first read about the system, and like you, I read the documentation, I actually read the entire spec and the crypto stuff that they explain. And it's just so clever. Like, it's such a clever system designed in a way that it does exactly what it needs to do. And at the same time, it doesn't expose any information about you. It's just perfect.
It's perfect. It's very elegant from an engineering perspective as well. And another thing that I think is important here that, you know, maybe some of these governments or, you know, agencies and things that are building these apps are perhaps not taking into account when they're designing these things, is that making these really private and secure and reliable, I think, is going to be really important also for the future, because this is one of those things where if the first version like that is being deployed doesn't work or gets hacked and then all of the data gets leaked and things like that, then people are not going to want to do it again in the future. And I think it's important for us to have some kind of system like this, you know, for the sake of everybody, that we can get these kind of exposure notifications for pandemics, because I don't mean to be too like doomy and gloomy here, but this is likely not the last pandemic that we'll see in our lifetime.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it is very important that the system works and that there are no privacy scandals involved, so that people can feel safe to use them in the future if needed. And the worst part about this is that the way things work nowadays for people who are into the news and especially international news, if something happens to the exposure notification system across the Atlantic from where I live, for instance, local news are going to report that, and people are going to think that it's the same. Like, you know what I mean? People are going to feel like the system is not safe, even if the problem happens in some place that's not using the API.
Right, exactly. So I'm happy to see that some countries are now starting to adopt the Apple and Google system because it does seem to be the best alternative so far, at least. And also that these code bases are open source so that, again, we can learn from them. Even people who are not working on this type of app, like, it's just interesting to see how they're implemented and how they're making use of this exposure notification system. So thumbs up for Italy and Switzerland for doing this. And I hope that more countries will follow.
Yeah.
Great. So now let's move ahead to our next segment, which is, of course, our technical deep dive. And on this week's episode, we're going to talk about reactive programming. But before we do, let's take a very quick break and thank this episode's sponsor. This week's episode of Stack Trace is brought to you by CiroSSL. CiroSSL is a new and completely free trusted certificate authority for SSL, aiming to make it easy and extremely affordable to create SSL certificates. It lets you get an SSL certificate for your API or website, which in turn lets you offer it over encrypted HTTPS traffic through an easy-to-use UI, and unlike other services like it, CiroSSL also provides an API that allows users to create both 90-day and 1-year validity certificates through an unprecedentedly easy and simple process, so that you can write scripts and automation to issue your certificates whenever you need them. CiroSSL offers both single domain, multi-domain, and wildcard certificates for free through the standard ACME protocol, and allows users to create 1-year certificates with an affordable subscription plan. And they've also got that REST API that I just mentioned as well. Unlike some of their competitors, CiroSSL also enables users to validate domain ownership via email, so not just via DNS, which makes it much easier and quicker to issue certificates via their web UI. Try CiroSSL for your website or web API by going to ZeroSSL.com, and we'll also leave a link in the show notes as well. Thanks a lot to CiroSSL for sponsoring this episode of StackTrace. All right, Rambo, so it's time for our deep dive segment. And on this week's episode, we're going to talk about reactive programming, which has many different shapes and forms and different frameworks. And it's been, I would say, on the kind of uprising during the last few years. There's been frameworks like RxSwift, which has become very popular in the Apple developer community. And of course, last WWDC Combine was introduced, which is Apple's own reactive programming framework. So before we kind of dive into reactive programming, what it is, and, you know, talk a little bit about how it works and all the different things, perhaps we could just start by talking about our own personal experiences with reactive programming. So how have you been using this style of programming, you know, for the last couple of years?
I've been using it on and off for quite a while. And one of the places where you can see me using it is the WWDC app we talked about recently. So it is a RxSwift and RxCocoa app. It uses it extensively, especially when dealing with communicating with the data model to keep the UI always in sync with the data that's on disk. And that's pretty much where, like, my only active project where I use it. But I do use it, of course, with Combine and SwiftUI every time I'm doing something using SwiftUI. So for now, that's the extent to where I use it.
Nice. And it's been kind of similar for me. I've been using it, RxSwift in particular, in a couple of different projects, mostly freelancing projects, when there's been a project I've been working on that has already had RxSwift in the code base, or when I've been working with a customer that I've been using RxSwift a lot and things like that. And then mostly as like a curiosity, because I always love looking into different new programming models and frameworks and see how they work. So RxSwift has, of course, been a very, very big and popular one, and just an interesting way of coding that has also become kind of ubiquitous across different kinds of platforms, where the whole idea of Rx came from C#. Like, it came from Microsoft platforms, and then has been ported into RxSwift, RxJava, and many others. So it's kind of like a larger ecosystem of frameworks, if you will. It's not just RxSwift. And then, of course, when Combine came out, and with SwiftUI, like you mentioned, like, when I've been building SwiftUI-based apps, I've been using Combine a lot for the bindings and the data and things like that. So that's been a lot of fun. But I will say that I'm not one of those people that have fully gone into reactive programming. And I think this might be an interesting discussion around what do we think reactive programming is good for and where are some of the limitations of it, perhaps, or what are some situations in which we might not choose to use it. But before we get into that, maybe we should start by just giving a little bit of an overview of reactive programming itself, like what it is and how it differs from other kinds of programming.
Yeah, sure. Let me try to give a very simple example here. So when it's kind of like the difference between imperative and declarative programming, but when talking about data flows. So when you are writing some, let's say a list that displays a list of countries and you have a database with the countries, one way to do it is for you to, when you open that screen in the app, you like fetch from the database, and then when the data arrives in the completion handler, you set an array on your view controller with the data. That's like the traditional way of doing things. Another way would be for you to bind what's on the list directly to a data stream that's connected to your database. So whenever the database changes, your UI will change no matter what. Because with the original example I gave, if you change something on the database, you'd need like some sort of notification or observer or something like that. But with the reactive programming model, you can have a data stream from your database and say, plug this into this UI component, and then things just happen.
Exactly. It's kind of a difference between a pull model and a push model, right?
Yep.
Where in the imperative world, or like in, for lack of a better term, traditional programming, you are kind of pulling data whenever you want to fetch something new. So a common pattern on iOS would be if in view will appear in your view controller, you will pull new data from the database so that when the view comes back on screen, you're pulling the latest data and you're rendering it. And then when some user action gets performed, or maybe you get like a push notification, or maybe you get a notification from a notification center or something, then you pull a new version of that model again. So the object that is consuming the data is pulling it into itself and requesting new copies of that data in an updated version whenever it feels like to. But with the reactive programming model, you more have a push model where, like you say, you establish a binding between an object that is observing another object. And then when the observed object is changed in any way and it says, well, here I have some new data, it pushes that down the stream, down to the observer. And that is a pretty nice programming model in some cases where you have that strong association between, for example, a UI and some underlying data, where you can always guarantee that the UI and the data will be in sync, because that is such a common area of bugs where you have one view that has done that pull and gotten that updated model, but then another view has not, and then they end up in this kind of unsynced states. And it's so common for crashes and bugs to start appearing in that situation.
Yeah, exactly. So you can achieve the exact same results with both reactive and, like you mentioned, traditional programming. But I'd say that using reactive programming, it's arguably easier to achieve and less error prone. So you're going to be doing more work to make sure you don't end up in those weird states, like you mentioned, with the traditional programming model. And it's also cool because you can apply operations that you're used to applying to things such as collections in Swift. You can apply those, but instead of applying them to a collection of things, you can apply it to a data stream. So you can map, you can flat map, you can filter. So you can do that type of operation with a data stream. So let's say you want to map from the thing that comes from your database into a view model every time. You don't have to do that manually. You can just add a map step to your data stream, and at the end of the pipe, you're getting your view model instead of whatever comes from your database.
Exactly. And this enables some really, really nice syntax where if you had before, let's say you had a network controller that you're calling to get some data, and then you get a closure with a result, and then you get another closure where you decode your JSON, and then another closure where you do some other transformation, and then you end up with this pyramid of doom, right? Where there's all these closures and there are different operations happening in each of them, and then at the end you call it a completion handler. And those can be really hard just to reason about mentally. When you look at that code, you'd be like, what is actually going on here? And then you look at the Rx or Combine or another kind of reactive programming library equivalents, and you got this super nice chain where it just says like load data, dot decode, dot map, dot filter. And then you got this really nice operations on that one pipeline or that data flow. And then at the end, you can just observe it and you get that final result out of it. So you can bind it to your view. And that looks incredibly elegant when you just look at that code.
Yeah, definitely. So you can do that, and you can also do other types of operations that do things in the time domain, since you're dealing with a stream of data. Things such as throttling. So the classic example of reactive programming that everyone always gives is the search field example. So you have a search field that has to fetch data from a network, but you, of course, don't want to send a network request for every single character the user has entered. So with reactive programming, it's very easy to solve that problem. You can throttle it so that it waits for the user to stop typing for, say, like a second, and filter so that it doesn't do the same fetch for the same search query again, and things like that. It of course, it's very doable without Rx, but it's super nice to do in Rx.
Yeah, and you've also got a lot of operators to combine, hence the name combine, data streams as well, yeah. Where if you have like two data streams, let's say you have input from different search fields, and you want to aggregate that into one object. And this is where you have to kind of start thinking in a slightly different way when you are working with reactive programming, because this is very different from how you might do the same task in the classic way. So you can combine all those search fields. Like, those search fields can all have publishers that publish the latest value or observables in RxSwift. And then you can combine the latest value from all of those into your model, and then you can send that model somewhere. And that can be really, really neat, because in the other way of doing things, you would have to check each search field and get those results manually and then combine those into your model and send that off. So again, it kind of takes all of that code that is kind of boilerplate and something you have to keep implementing specifically for each use case and implements it as a reusable operation that you can then plug into anywhere where you need that specific task.
Yeah, absolutely.
But all of this also, now it might sound like we're huge fans of reactive programming, and I am a fan of reactive programming. I think it's really neat, but I think it also has some significant downsides and limitations. So we just talked about how the syntax can be really, really elegant when you have that nice pipeline where everything is operations and you can do things like throttling and combine, and you can bring in other data sources, you can merge things together. And there's a way where you could almost write your entire app as one big data flow, you know, where like some input comes in at the top, like an app state, and then you just filter that out to all your views. And then when some action happens, you just send that into the model again, and then you go through the whole chain again. And you're looking at that when you've finished working on it and you build something like that, and it just looks incredibly elegant. But then you need to debug it, or you need to change something, or something goes wrong. And it can just be really, really difficult to know where something goes wrong or where to put your breakpoints, because there are no, like, there's no real code execution anywhere. It's just a bunch of operations. So I think that it's important to always try to strike a nice balance between using what reactive programming is really great for, which is like data transformations and binding events to views and binding network requests and things, but to then have the glue in between kind of go out of the reactive programming world. So you have these two reactive kind of edges, and then in the middle you can put your own logic.
Yeah, absolutely. Things like RxSwift and RxCoco, which is the Coco bindings for RxSwift, they have features that allow you to do things such as hook into collection views and table views, for instance, I don't use any of that stuff because I think it goes too far and it ends up masking away AppKit or UIKit from me in a way I don't like and in a way I lose control of what's happening. So I always leave it until a certain level in my app lifecycle, and from that point on, then I just do, quote, traditional programming. If you look at the WWDC app itself, you're going to see something like that. Like, there are table views and collection views in the app, but they're not bound using Rx Swift. The Rx stuff is from the database to the view model, and then there's just an array somewhere that populates the table view or collection view. I feel like that's a saner way to work than, like, let's do everything 100% Rx. I think that goes into what we talked about before when talking about app architecture, that you should avoid letting a third-party dependency dominate your app architecture. You should use what the platform suggests and use those tools as a way to augment what you're doing and make some things easier and better.
Absolutely. Because I think there's a huge difference between building an Rx Swift app versus building an app that uses Rx Swift, right? Yeah. Like, those are two very different things. And what you're saying is more like building an app that uses Rx Swift or uses Combine for, like, the data flows, for observation of events and things like that. And that's what they're really, really good for. Like, they remove a bunch of boilerplate. They enable you to use those, like, reusable operators and things like that that are really, really neat. But then, like, the actual logic that happens in between, I think, is usually good to make, like, agnostic of those libraries, even if the libraries come from Apple, like Combine, because we know that things change over time, and it's usually more flexible to have something that is implemented without such a heavy reliance on one specific tool. And another thing also is that I think if you lean too much into the reactive programming model and you build, like, an Rx Swift app or a Combine app, I feel like you sometimes end up using these tools even for tasks that they're not really good for. So they're very, very good for, like, this continuous stream of events. Like, that's really what they're for. And that's even in their tag phrase, right? Like, a stream of values over time. That's what they are. But not all problems are a stream of values over time. Of course, you could model it this way. You could say that, okay, this thing that happens only once, for example, if I'm saving out some data to a file, I can treat that as a stream because it's a continuous saving of values to a file. But if it isn't, then you're kind of forcing the model, I feel like, into that domain, even though it's kind of a mismatch. So for me, it's always really important to use the tools that I have and the tools that I brought into my project for the job that they're good for, but to not be afraid to step out of that model and, again, not let it influence my overall architecture too much so that it becomes awkward to step out of that model whenever I need to.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking about our usage that we mentioned earlier, the main reason why I don't use reactive programming more often and in, like, all of my projects is because until recently, and still now to some extent because Combine is iOS 13 only, it required quite a big dependency, which is Rx Swift in the case of Swift projects. And I feel like that's too big a dependency, and I don't really like dependencies, as we've established before. So yeah. I do use it on the WWDC app. I'm way less hesitant to use dependencies in that app because it's an open source project that I do on my free time and things like that. But for my commercial projects, I really dislike dependencies, like we talked about. And I haven't seen a reactive library that's not significantly large, and I wouldn't use one that's not highly maintained, like the Rx Swift one. But of course, that's trade-offs, so each project has different trade-offs, and it's not that using dependencies is wrong, like we talked about before. It's just my personal preference. But yeah, I feel like I am going to start using reactive programming a lot more as I start developing new apps that target the new OSs.
Yeah, me too. At least for kind of the data part of the app and for the communication part, mm-hmm. While still keeping some of the other parts more, you know, old school, if you will. And along those lines, another technique or metaphor that you can use, which I've been using quite a lot in the past couple of years, is futures and promises, which is similar to Rx in many ways, in that it's also enables that nice kind of syntax and those nice pipelines where you can, from an operation, you can, instead of having that completion handler that you have to call, you instead return a future. And then that future can be observed and it can also be mapped and mutated and transformed. But the difference is that a future is just a one use object, like a future or a promise. While when you set up those reactive programming pipelines, those are kind of ongoing for the most part. And then you can set them up and you can keep observing them. So it's a slightly different model. I would say it's a kind of simpler model to use futures and promises, which is why I've used it for most projects for the last couple of years instead of something like Rx, because it's been a kind of easier model to get into and to make compatible with the rest of the ecosystem instead of, again, having to lean too much into the whole reactive programming world. I'm still using futures and promises a fair bit, and I've written some kind of glue code to enable me to convert futures and promises into Combine publishers, even though Combine also does ship with a future type, which I think it's a bit of a strange type because it's kind of not a future and it's kind of not a publisher. So it's kind of sitting in between. But it is really, really nice to be able to pick different metaphors depending on what kind of problem you're looking to solve.
Yeah, definitely. I use your tiny futures and promises library in Chibi Studio, by the way.
Nice. That's really cool. And if someone is looking to use that, I don't have one on GitHub that you can just clone, but I have an article where you can build one for yourself from scratch. So
that's the best dependency. Just copy and paste the code.
Exactly. Well, you shouldn't copy and paste it. You should read the article and go through it and learn. That's how you build it. It's like build your own dependency day.
DIY.
Exactly. Awesome. So that's been our deep dive into reactive programming. Of course, if you want us to follow up on any of these things or if you want us to talk more about any of these aspects, then feel free to tweet at us with the hashtag AskStackTrace and we'll answer your question on a future episode. But now let's do just that and answer a AskStackTrace question. This one is not about reactive programming, but instead comes from Peter. And Peter wants to hear if we worry that something like Flutter or React Native will replace Swift and native development and that companies will go cross-platform more and more. And also, do we think that Swift UI will eventually become cross-platform? So this is a very, very kind of long-standing debate and question and things that people think about is, will cross-platform development take over native development? And this has been something that's been asked for like decades. So Rambo, can we give a little bit of a refreshed kind of thinking, a 2020 opinion on this topic?
Every time I see this discussion again, the word again always pops into my head, because this is something that's, like you mentioned, been talked about for decades. I think back when I was a web developer, people thought that Dreamweaver would replace HTML and CSS, or that Flash would become the standard for web development. And it just never happens. Every year, it seems it's not every year, but every couple of years or so, it seems that there's a new offer for cross-platform development. And everyone goes crazy about it, and big tech companies migrate their apps to use that new thing. And then a couple of years later, they release a blog post on Medium talking about how it didn't work.
that's like quite literally what happens.
It is exactly what happens. You can go back and you can find those articles. So yeah, I really have a hard time. And I'm not talking about Flutter specifically. I'm talking about any cross-platform technology that aims, I'm not saying Flutter aims at doing the replacing native development. I'm saying, like, people always tend to have this vision that these cross-platform tools are going to replace native development, and it's just never happened, and I don't see a reason why it would happen now.
I think one thing that is important to keep in mind here is that any third-party tool, whether it's a cross-platform tool or just a tool in general, will always have a kind of steep hill to climb, where, as we know, the platforms that we work on, iOS, macOS, or if you're developing for Android or something else, they keep changing every single year. And these cross-platform technologies, they have to continuously adapt to that, and they have to keep up with the system. And they don't get a heads-up notice, right? Like, Apple is not telling the Flutter team, hey, guess what we're announcing at WWDC here a week from now? Like, they're not doing that, right? So they always have to react to changes in the platform, just like we have as third-party developers.
React? I see what you did there.
Right, exactly. There you go. The problem there is that since they have this layer that is sitting between the developer and the platform, that can become both a blocker. It can also become a thing where they have to follow the kind of lowest denominator on each platform that they support, which means that if one platform starts advancing and then the other platforms do not, they're kind of stuck in the past, if you will. And this is a lot what has happened with these libraries that you mentioned that companies have migrated to and then migrated from. And again, we're not talking about Flutter here specifically or React Native or things like that, but it's in general harder for third-party platforms, like not libraries, but platforms, things like technologies that aim to more or less like act as a layer or replace the native developer tools. That's always going to be a steep hill for those to climb.
Yeah, and I'm also of the opinion that they produce substandard apps, but I understand that there are some situations where it can be a good solution, especially if you're like a small company or a startup and you don't have the resources. It can be a good starting point, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And it's again, all about trade-offs, right?
Yeah.
But the question here is, do we worry? And I don't worry, because let's imagine a future world where Flutter is so great and so good that it's better than native development. And Apple says, well, okay, we're just going to invest in Flutter because it's the future and everybody invests in Flutter and we can all build cross-platform apps and it's the future we all wanted and everybody's super happy. I'm not going to be sad about that.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm going to get a great development experience out of it and I'm going to be able to build the products I can build, great. Like, I will just switch to that. I will just do Flutter by Sundell. You know, that's just what will happen, right? So I don't worry about these things because it's not like I am so invested in Swift in particular. It might seem like it because, you know, everything I do is around Swift, around my website and everything. But I'm adaptable. Like, if a new development platform will take over and become the thing to work with, I will just start working with that. That's fine by me. But like you say, Rambo, I don't think it will happen for any technology that is A, not embraced by the native vendors. And I know that Google is behind Flutter, but still they have Kotlin that they're supporting and stuff like that. So I don't think it's the same. And that are cross-platform, because I think it's just going to be so difficult for these tools to ever catch up with the native tools.
Also, you mentioned it's by Google, and Google has a thing with killing their products. So and
right.
Services, and I guess Flutter could be considered a service. So we know that they like to shut down things frequently. So yeah. But yeah, I'm with you on that. And it's happened before. Like, I started with web development and then I moved to Mac and iOS development. And I didn't like iOS development when iOS had just come out. Like, it was called iPhone OS back then. I wasn't really a fan of UI kits. I was an app kit person. And then Apple released Swift. I was not happy when Apple released Swift. I was scared. I wasn't a fan from day one. I had to learn, and it was a learning curve. And people who are listening might be saying, well, but Swift is better than Objective-C. Well, I didn't think it was when they released it, but I ended up liking it later and getting used to it and learning. So I think I am also adaptive, so I can definitely adapt to whatever new technology is introduced.
Exactly. And I think that's a really important characteristic for a developer to have, because Even though we might be really excited about Swift right now, or Combine, or RxSwift, or reactive programming, whatever like we're excited about right now, chances are pretty high that that will change over time. So I think it's important to, even though you might be a fan of something or be excited about something, or you know, you might invest in it in terms of learning it, to be adaptive and to realize that sooner or later things are going to change. And rather than always just holding on to the past and holding on to that technology that you liked, to have an open mind and to look around. And I've tried Flutter, I've tried React Native. I am, like we mentioned on the previous episode, I am occasionally trying new languages. I am coding in Rust and Haskell and all different languages, because I think it's important to kind of look up and look outside of the realm of Apple and Swift as well to see what's going on. But it's just like the whole nature, like we mentioned now a few times, of cross-platform frameworks that I just think is kind of doomed to fail in a way, or not fail, but doomed to always lag behind the native tools.
Yeah, doomed to always be an option and not the default.
Right, that's a better way of putting it. So just the final part of this question here now, just to touch on that a bit as well, do we ever think that Swift UI will eventually be cross-platform? What do you think, Rambo?
Nah. No, it's not something Apple would do, I think. Unless they make it open source, which I don't see happening as well, because it's very tied to underlying things on Apple's systems, which are not open source. So yeah, I really don't see that happening.
Yeah, that's the thing. When people say that they want Swift UI to be open sourced, I'm thinking, what would that be? Like, what would be open source? Like, the engine that maps to native use, maybe? Like, that's maybe what you could open source, but that's probably a pretty tiny part of Swift UI. And then you have just all of the rest, which is just the native proprietary platform views and controls, and those are not open source, and probably you should never say never, but will probably not be in a reasonable amount of time. So I don't think there's an incentive here also for Apple to build like a web version of Swift UI or an Android version. Like, what would they even use that for? So yeah, I'm kind of skeptical. I would be super happy to see it become more of a cross-platform thing or to be open source, but I really just don't see it happening.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if like a few years from now, Apple releases an update of the Apple Music app for Android, and then someone spelunks the app and finds out that they're using some special version of Swift UI for Android. But then it would be like an Apple internal thing only. I don't think they would ever open that. It would be like UXKit. Remember UXKit?
Exactly, yeah. Would that be Swift AI? Swift Android interface?
Maybe.
Maybe. All right. And on that note, let's end this week's episode. So hope you enjoyed it. And thanks to Peter for that great question, and for everybody who's been asking us questions using Ask Stacktrace. And again, also a big thanks to everyone who is sharing Stacktrace with that hashtag as well. Thanks also to our great sponsor for this episode, ZeroSSL. Make sure to check them out as well. And that's about it. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.